explosive debate, breaking news, and uncensored views. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. It is not only the day that we go into our meaningful, important, and particularly needed Thanksgiving holiday, but it's a day when we have something special to be thankful for, a proof, a direct proof that, yes, the American system works. It isn't broken. It isn't racist or biased or somehow partial or loused up. The American system of criminal justice, while it's imperfect, and there obviously are mistakes that are made from time to time, can do the right thing. I'm referring, of course, to the convictions in the Ahmaud Arbery murder trial. And the announcement was made by a very sober and serious-minded judge who then provoked a reaction that he didn't really want, but it sounded like this in the courtroom in Georgia. Listen, this is
in the Superior Court of Glynn County, State of Georgia. The State of Georgia versus Travis McMichael, case number CR0R00433. Jury verdict form. Count one, malice murder. We, the jury, find the defendant, Travis McMichael, guilty. I'm going to ask that whoever just made an outburst be removed from the court, please.
Okay, and they were. It took them a moment to be removed from the courtroom. Now, there was an outburst, of course, from the family of Ahmaud Arbery, but they were outside the courtroom in a holding room, a separate room. And it's hard to feel wonderful about anything concerning a hideous case like this, where there's a completely pointless killing. But the fact that it turns out after controversy and condemnation, there was a great deal of negativity at the beginning of this case, as you may remember, because there was a delay with the local prosecutors in terms of bringing charges against the McMichaels, who are now guilty of murder. And by the way, this was, as people have pointed out time and time again, a jury that included 11 whites and one black. And in fact, Al Sharpton called attention to that. He's obviously feeling relieved. Clip 18.
And let the word go forth all over the world.
Yes. Yes,
that a jury of 11 whites,
yeah,
and one black,
come on,
in the deep South,
good God,
stood up in the courtroom and said that black lives do matter.
Come on. Yeah.
Let it be clear,
yeah,
that almost 10 years after Trayvon, God used Wanda and Marcus's son to prove that if we kept marching and kept fighting, we would make you hear us. We got a lot more battles to fight,
yes,
but this was an important battle today.
Yes. Yes.
This was proving that our children know their value.
Okay, this he was referring to Marcus and Wanda Cooper Jones is Ahmaud Arbery's mother, and losing a 25-year-old son under circumstances like this, of course it's painful, but she's been impressive throughout the process. She said before the trial began that she was confident that it would be a fair trial, and she was confident that even a jury that is overwhelmingly white could see the justice of the prosecution. Here's her reaction outside the courthouse today. Clip 20.
I just want to say thank you guys.
Yes.
Thank
yes.
guys.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank each and every one of you who fought this fight with us. It's been a long fight. It's been a hard fight. But God is good.
Yes, he is.
Early in, I never saw this day back in 2020.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I never thought this day would come.
Well, the day has come. And you may notice that for at least two of the defendants, they were held not guilty of the charge of malice murder, but they were convicted for the case of a felony murder. William Rhody Bryan, the neighbor who was busy videotaping these events, was also held not guilty of felony murder. He was convicted in terms of aggravated assault, false imprisonment, and criminal attempt to commit a felony. They're all facing life imprisonment, and which is remarkable. What's the difference between malice murder and felony murder? These are terms that are applicable in the state of Georgia. Malice murder means that's the, quote, deliberate intention unlawfully to take the life of another human being where no considerable provocation appears. The killer must also show an abandoned and malignant heart. And it's the equivalent of first-degree murder in most states. It's your classic murder charge. Felony murder works differently. And that's why the Gregory McMichael, who was not the one who actually pulled the trigger, can be convicted of felony murder, but not of malice murder. A felony murder, a person can be charged and convicted of felony murder without actually killing someone. Take, for instance, Greg McMichael and Rhody Bryan in the Arbery case. Neither of them pulled the trigger, but the video of the killing shows it was Travis McMichael. But the way felony murder works, if the jury finds they committed felonies that resulted in Arbery's death, that results in a felony murder conviction. Now, where it goes from here, believe it or not, is another trial. What kind of other trial? That's going to be the federal trial. The federal trial on civil rights charges, where they should probably save the effort here and make some kind of a plea deal, because on federal charges, because they're already facing life imprisonment on the state charges where we just heard the verdict. The one thing that I have wondered about, is there anyone out there, a public figure, any member of Congress, Republican or Democrat, any white supremacist organization, anything, where people have said that these folks are innocent, that these folks should be found not guilty, should be not prosecuted? Which, by the way, shows how it was always ridiculous to try to say that there was a racial element to the Kyle Rittenhouse trial or the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict. It wasn't racial. It was white victims and a white perpetrator, a white defendant. And the truth of the matter is the cases are so profoundly different, but at its very core, and it's like a law lesson to everybody in the country, that if you are going to plead self-defense, you can't plead that self-defense involves you chasing someone down the street, surrounding him by pickup trucks. In other words, if you are the aggressor, you're not going to be able to win a trial of self-defense. So what does it mean for the country? What it means is we are a great country. We have a lot to be thankful for. And people who say that America isn't moving ahead in race relations toward greater equality, not paying attention. But a lot for us to pay attention to this Thanksgiving Eve. We'll be right back.
The Michael Medved Show. MichaelMedved.com. The Michael Medved Show. All across America. This is The Michael Medved Show.
And on the Michael Medved Show, Thanksgiving coming up, more controversial than ever, we're told. There's actually a tradition over at the Wall Street Journal, and it's a tradition that I love. They have the same editorial. It's actually a historical document, a description from eyewitnesses about who the pilgrims were, and they print that. They've done every year since 1961. Really, that's pretty amazing when you think about it. And they've been doing this without objection. People love it. I love it. I've even commented to folks at the Journal that I know how much I appreciate it. There's now been a petition campaign to eliminate their Thanksgiving editorial because it's not fair to Native Americans and it's prejudiced and it's racist, and we will get to that. There is also a new move that seems to be unstoppable to expand the franchise, meaning to get more people registered and eligible to vote. The problem here is that the 800,000 people who would suddenly get the right to vote in New York City elections are non-citizens. Not illegals. They're people who are here legally, but they're non-citizens. Is that a good idea? I happen to think it's a terrible idea. It's just an awful idea. We will get to that. And we will get to the editor of a new series of children's books called Heroes of Liberty, which tries to extol some of the values that we honor on Thanksgiving, and that we also honor on all of our national holidays and should continue to honor. But those values are not particularly demonstrated in this story, which actually I think is a very important story, because there is a great deal of emphasis, particularly on the left side of things, to try to emphasize people's intentions rather than the actual impact of what they do. And this is from the New York Times, believe it or not, and it's just a startling story and one that should be a wake-up to everybody. During the mid-2010s, New York City paid a nonprofit in the Bronx more than $10 million to house, to feed, and to provide social services to homeless families at a 100-room homeless shelter. $10 million is a substantial amount. According to the nonprofit's executive director, whose name is Ethel Denise Perry, here is where much of that money went. Her gym membership, her car payments, shopping sprees at Bergdorf Goodman, Bloomingdale's, Ferragamo, Neiman Marcus, Manolo Blahnik, Tiffany, and other luxury retailers. Her brother and nephew were put on the payroll of the nonprofit, which is called Millennium Care. Altogether, Ms. Perry admitted using money the city paid Millennium Care to cover over $1 million in personal credit card bills, according to a plea agreement with the state attorney general's office she signed on Friday. She took a total beyond her salary of $2,394,169. Can you believe it? I mean, and by the way, this is not a first. They've had a series of this kind of thievery, which is despicable and ought to bring very long prison terms, and won't, unfortunately. But even after the Attorney General's office came after her for failing to file taxes 3 years in a row, she kept defrauding the authorities, belatedly reporting, for instance, $31,000 in income for 2015, when Millennium Care actually paid her that year $700,000. How do you get $700,000 for being director of a homeless shelter that the city is paying $10 million for. This is insane. Ms. Perry was able to use the nonprofit as her personal piggy bank in part because it had no board of directors. Great. It failed to file required financial reports with the state and the IRS, and according to the plea agreement, carried out its business in a persistently illegal manner, and did this for years and years and years, while people who were authorizing this kind of taxpayer money thought, oh, we're helping the homeless. Yeah, this is really, really helping them. This is doing so much good for people. Well, it's doing good for Ethel Denise Perry. And so Ms. Perry, who owns two houses in the Bronx and also runs a dance studio, becomes the latest city homeless shelter operator who was found to have committed fiscal wrongdoing. In the plea bargain reached in state Supreme Court in Manhattan, Ms. Perry pleaded guilty to tax fraud, and Millennium Care pleaded guilty to grand larceny. Ms. Perry was sentenced to 5 years probation and must pay $1.1 million in taxes and penalties. In other words, if she's sentenced to probation, that means she doesn't go behind bars. That means she's just limited in things that she can do. She has to stay around. And she's also being asked to pay back some, but not all, of the money she stole. She also must pay $1.1 million in taxes and penalties. Millennium Care will pay a fine of $2,394,169, the exact amount that Ms. Perry overpaid herself, and Millennium Care also will be dissolved. As stealing money that is earmarked for people experiencing homelessness is an immoral as it gets, and it's illegal, said Attorney General Letitia James, is running for governor. Okay, this has been a pattern in New York. The nonprofits that the city contracts with to run shelters have been so rife with self-dealing, nepotism, and conflicts of interest that Mayor Bill de Blasio has ordered an audit of every nonprofit group in the system. 9 of the 62 groups that run shelters are on an internal city watch list. Earlier this year, for example, the former head of one of the city's biggest shelter networks, Victor Rivera, was charged with pocketing hundreds of thousands of dollars in kickbacks from contractors. Last year, the city filed suit accusing a nonprofit called Children's Community Services, which operated 28 shelters, of defrauding by funneling payments to subcontractors that did not provide the supplies and the services they were paid for. Okay, it's great to think of charity on Thanksgiving and helping homeless people and other people and people who need help. But we need help for doing it legally, please. We will be right back. On the Michael Medved Show, it is obviously a very, very big time of year. It's a big time of year in terms of the economy. Will the loosening up of a bunch of new petroleum from the nation's petroleum reserve? We're joined in that endeavor by Japan and South Korea and Great Britain and Germany, I believe. And they also have some petroleum reserves, and they're releasing some of it. Don't expect a huge drop in gas prices, because basically when you actually see what's happening here, it's not going to be enough to make an immediate difference. This comes at a time when skyrocketing gas prices are already having an impact on the way we celebrate this holiday. Listen to this report from ABC, clip 5.
For drivers, relief can't come soon enough. In just the past year, the average price for a gallon of gas has soared to $3.40. That's $1.29 higher than this time last year.
Just fill up my car, it's like $65.
Khadijah Baxter and her four kids usually drive to spend Thanksgiving with family, but not this year.
Riding around is a no. You have to fill up again by the end of the week.
Okay, and Jennifer Granholm, the energy secretary, former governor of Michigan, former Hollywood actress, as a matter of fact, years ago. And in any event, it's another story. No, she really is. And that was what she did after, I think it was she went to University of California at Berkeley and then came to Michigan later in her life. Anyway, Jennifer Granholm was doing a White House press conference about the release of this 50 million gallons that's going to be going out there to help, one hopes, bring down the price of gas. She's asked by a reporter kind of a pertinent question, clip 8.
There are various figures about this, so I'm curious if you know, how many barrels of oil does the U.S. consume per day?
I don't have that number in front of me. Sorry.
So some suggest it's about 18 million, which would suggest you're releasing less than 3 days' worth of supply from the petroleum reserve.
Okay, shouldn't she really be prepared when she's making an announcement like this with knowing how many millions of gallons we actually are getting with this entire thing? And then there is this from Secretary Granholm. She doesn't appear to be as concerned about the high gas prices as you'd think she would be. This is an online interview, clip 10.
The bottom line is that this president and this administration are looking at every single tool to shield American families from the impact of rising energy prices. And we're working through an energy transition. And we've got to start by adding energy. And the reality is we have to take some time to get off of oil and gas. We recognize this. This is a transition.
Okay. Is that the right context to talk about getting off oil and gas at a time when people are desperate to get the gas so they can go visit grandma? She was asked about her plan to lower gas prices on Bloomberg News. This is clip 4.
In Sturgis, Michigan, it is $2.89 a gallon. I guess that's better than in California. What is the Granholm plan to increase oil production in America?
That is hilarious. Would that I had the magic wand on this. As you know, of course, oil is a global market. It is controlled by a cartel. That cartel is called OPEC.
Okay, what does that have to do with a Granholm plan? Shouldn't the United States? The United States did become energy independent in recent years. And is that gone now? Is that done? The Peter Doocy asked, who's gotten to be a pretty endearingly obnoxious Fox News reporter, he had a kind of tough question for Jen Psaki on Biden's Thanksgiving travel plans. Go ahead.
What message does it send to the middle-class Americans President Biden says that he's trying to help, who are struggling this week to cover the cost of the most expensive Thanksgiving ever, that the president is going to take a few days off at a billionaire's compound in Nantucket?
Well, first I would say, I don't know if you've cooked a turkey before, but a 20-pound turkey is a pretty big turkey. I think we can all agree. They're about $1 more. So not to minimize that, any increase in prices is something the president is concerned about, as is evidenced by his announcement today and as his efforts to push forward on additional relief for the American people. But I just want to be clear that there are abundance of turkeys available. They're about $1 more for a 20-pound bird, which is a huge bird if you're feeding a very big family.
Okay, do you notice he was asked about what kind of message does Biden send with his own vacation plans? And then she immediately starts talking turkey. Really? Turkey? And Then there's this from Stephen Colbert, who's also talking about the best look for Biden. That's a clip 17.
Some people who shall remain president of the United States knocked off early. Because today, Joe Biden hit the road to spend Thanksgiving in Nantucket, reviving a family tradition. Reminds me of the famous limerick. There once was a man in Nantucket whose poll numbers really did suck it. At least he is not that orange Pol Pot who ate all his meals from a bucket.
And there's also this from Colbert on his CBS show about releasing...
One little snag in the holiday travel has been high gas prices. So before he left town, the president announced he will release 50 million barrels of oil from the Strategic Reserve. Now, for those who don't know, that man does know. For those who don't know, the Strategic Reserve is a series of caverns filled with fossil fuel and strategically located inside Rudy Giuliani's head. According... Overflowing. Got to release it. Got to release the pressure.
Get it out.
According to the president, this is the largest release from the reserve in U.S. history. It's not clear if this is going to work. Energy experts have consistently said such a release would do little to lower prices at the pump. It's also not the best look right after you come back from a climate conference. We must end our addiction to fossil fuels. What's that? Gas is $3.50 a gallon. Let the rivers be choked with crude oil and the carcasses of pelicans.
And what's astonishing to me is they're talking about in Michigan, the gas is at $2.80-something, they said. And in California, we were just there at the Reagan Library. It was like $5. There is a difference among the states. And by the way, is it any accident that some of the states that are... How do you say the most climate conscious are the ones where the gas prices tend to be higher? We will get to that and to the idea of blocking a pro-Thanksgiving editorial that's been something of a tradition for the Wall Street Journal. And why would you block it? Because it supposedly whitewashes, you'll pardon me, that term is used deliberately, it whitewashes the guilt of the white pilgrims. So what do you need to do to answer that kind of objection? We'll talk about that. And by the way, you can check out my column in Newsweek today about that, which mentions two numbers to keep a decent perspective on the Thanksgiving story. We will be right back on The Medved Show.
The Michael Medved Show. MichaelMedved.com.
I'm a big Michael Medved fan.
The Michael Medved Show.
And on the Michael Medved Show, there is a terrific little editorial. And it's not their traditional Thanksgiving editorial. It's different. But it actually came out in the newspaper yesterday at the Wall Street Journal under the heading, Censoring the Pilgrims. And the subheading, The Left Wants to Cancel Our Annual Thanksgiving Editorials. No doubt it was only a matter of time, says the Journal. The progressives have come for our annual Thanksgiving editorials. They won't succeed, but we thought we'd share the tale with readers for an insight into the politicization of absolutely everything, even Thanksgiving. Since 1961, we've run a pair of editorials written by our former editor, Vermont Royster. The first is a historical account. It's in the words of William Bradford, who was a frequently the governor of Plymouth Colony, and certainly the one who left the best record of the experience of the Pilgrims landing in 1620 and building their community and then leading that community for many years. And but we live in a new era, writes the editorial, it's unsigned, from yesterday. Right now we live in a new era when the left sees nearly everything through the reductive lens of identity politics. It sees much of American history as a racist project that should be erased. This is the motivation of a petition campaign to censor the Pilgrim editorial. The effect comes by the effort comes via change.org, which is a website that calls itself the world's platform for change. Well, that's modest. It mobilizes campaigns to promote progressive causes. The petition driver is Randy Kritkowski, an author who writes about Native Americans. His platform has gathered some 50,000 signatures for a petition, and here's its argument. The argument says, tell the Wall Street Journal that it's 2021, time to stop publishing 17th century racism. The editorial includes lines such as, what could they see but a hideous and desolate wilderness full of wild beasts and wild men? The Pilgrim writes that they were separate from all the civil parts of the world. And then he says, the Wampanoag indigenous people saved the colonists from starvation and death, a story that our nation now celebrates as Thanksgiving. But even more than this disturbing lack of gratitude is the notion that there were no civilized people in the Americas. This worldview generated centuries of genocidal practices that eliminated 90% of the indigenous population, my ancestors. This is this guy, Randy Kritkowski, has Native American ancestors. The point about this is that people talk about the mythology of the Pilgrim story as we were taught it in elementary school. There are some things that the story got wrong. There were no cranberries. There weren't a lot of women because, as I point out in my editorial today in Newsweek, most of the women had died. The overwhelming majority, there were only five wives who survived the first winter, which was devastating. Over half the Pilgrims died. And they died not of starvation as much as various diseases. They didn't have good food. They didn't have food that was safe. They suffered from scurvy. And what they were celebrating basically was survival. And the idea that the Indians as a group came over and taught them to farm and taught them to fish and taught them how to survive because these poor dumb Europeans didn't know anything about that, that's not entirely true, and that's not what happened. There was one Indian who had already become a Christian. He had been enslaved by people passing that area, fishermen and basically privateers, pirates in a sense, who captured him when he was 12. His name is Tisquantum. The Pilgrims called him Squanto. I don't know how that happened. But he was clearly someone who identified with their community. His family had died in disease 3 years before the Pilgrims arrived. You can't blame that for it. And he lived with them. But that story that we all learned, where supposedly Squanto taught them how to take fish and to use the fish as fertilizer to help your corn grow, to help things grow in the ground, that's probably not true. Charles Mann, who is a fairly distinguished historian about what America was like before European arrivals, there is no evidence anywhere that Wampanoags or other Indians knew that thing about putting a dead fish into a hole along with the seeds to help the crops grow. It's brilliant, but Squanto learned that in England because he spent a while in England before he got back after having been liberated by Franciscan monks who got him out of slavery. He then went to England, lived there, and that's where he would have learned that, because in the part of England where the East Anglia, where the Puritans came from and the Pilgrims came from, that was something that was widely practiced there. In any event, that's a relatively minor difference. The important thing here, and it's, today there's actually a very nice editorial in the New York Times, but it's an editorial about exercising your gratitude muscles, and there's they quote a Kisha James, who's a member of the Aquina Wampanoag tribe in New England. She told Boston's WBUR last year that she does not object to Thanksgiving gatherings, but rather the false mythology surrounding the day. Try to divorce your Thanksgiving celebrations from the Thanksgiving mythology, she suggested. So no more pilgrims and Indians, no more teaching your children about the first Thanksgiving as we learn it in the public school, where it was a friendly meal. It was a friendly meal. And the important part of the meal, and it's undeniable, they concluded a treaty, an agreement between the great Wampanoag chief Massasoit and King James. They pilgrims acted in the name of King James. I mean, and that alliance between the Wampanoags and the pilgrims lasted for more than 50 years. And the, quote, Indian massacres, the Wampanoags fought alongside the pilgrims because they were defending themselves, and the pilgrims were, from the Pequots and other bands who were quite negative, who were their joint enemies. And the fact that this lasted for 50 years, why is that so significant? Because it was when that alliance broke apart, 50 years after the first Thanksgiving, so several generations, what happened was Massasoit's son, whose name was Metacomet, and he's better known as King Philip because he so styled himself, he was trying to lead and organize an Indian confederacy to wipe out the white settlements, which had already been there, again, for 50 years. And that is where that was the most grim battle between whites and Indians in New England history, certainly. 5% of the population of Connecticut was slaughtered because there were massacres, frankly, on both sides. It's King Philip's War, it's known as. But again, that's two generations after the Pilgrims. So don't sully this Thanksgiving by saying, no, there was no friendship, there was no... Because the two people, Edward Winslow and William Bradford, who both left written records of the first Thanksgiving, unfortunately, we don't know the exact date that it occurred, but it was in the fall of 1621. And they had a reasonable harvest after all of this dying and this bare survival. The notion that pilgrims were arrogant conquerors, that they were like the Spanish conquistadors, it's garbage. It's nonsense. And I would urge people to do two things. Number one is to check out the editorial today that I did for Newsweek about keeping the story straight regarding the pilgrims and the first Thanksgiving. But secondly, sign up as a MedHead member and MedHead Plus member, and you will have access to colonial history, the real colonial history, which is more complicated but more inspiring ultimately than anything else. By the way, they ran the editorials despite the 50,000 people who signed a petition saying they shouldn't. We don't mind giving critics a chance to make their case, says the journal, but we won't bend to political demands for censorship. We will run the editorial.